This is a WSMI podcast from the Tally Broadcasting Station.
Thank you. The U.S. House passed a rule Tuesday to allow debate on the Farm Bill conference report today. The vote was 224 to 192, with Republicans voting heavily for the rule and Democrats voting against it. Reports are that the vote is largely due to the fact that the rule also covers a bill banning the use of taxpayer money to pay for abortions. The House was scheduled to go into session at 9 o'clock Eastern Time this morning. That should allow for completion of the farm bill before adjournment for a Republican retreat. House Agriculture Committee Chair Frank Lucas predicted Tuesday that the legislation will have the votes to pass in the House. While the bill has not yet been scheduled in the Senate, Majority Leader Harry Reid has endorsed the bill, and Senate Agriculture Chair Debbie Stabenow is confident the farm bill will be approved. Lucas and Stabenow also believe President Barack Obama will sign the bill. Lucas called the measure a really amazing bill, and given the budget situation and the atmosphere in Congress, he said it's not just a good farm bill, but almost a miracle. Lucas also believes the bill should be considered a prototype bill for congressional action to cut the deficit. Currently, propane supplies are extremely tight in the U.S. What does this mean for farmers and ranchers? There are several factors that have caused the current propane situation, according to American Farm Bureau Environment and Energy Policy Specialist Andrew Walmsley.
We had a pretty large harvest towards the end of last year that was relatively wet. It drew down some propane supplies. During the same time, there was what the propane industry is calling infrastructure realignments, where we've seen some pipelines out of service, along with some impacts to rail rerouting, too, for propane traveling by train. And then one of the other issues is propane exports are up quite a bit. Last year, we saw about 20% of total U.S. propane was exported, and this is up from just 5% in 2008.
Walmsley says relief from cold weather could be extremely helpful, especially for southern chicken growers.
Keeping those birds warm are a concern, and we see a blast of Arctic air just this week. So a little relief in the weather would be the most helpful.
There has been some relief on the regulatory side.
Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration has relieved some of the pressures on transporting propane in regards to hours of service, allowing drivers to work a little longer to make sure they can get deliveries out there.
Walmsley says livestock producers especially will be impacted without relief soon.
Be able to keep those houses warm both for our swine and our poultry that are out there. Obviously, first concern is folks being able to keep their homes heated, but if this was a long-term impact, it would definitely have a negative impact on agricultural production.
Walmsley says the most important thing is for consumers to stay in close contact with their propane supplier. The frigid weather has been lingering and is causing more serious problems than just making it unpleasant to go outside. I spoke with Arlen Suderman of Water Street Solutions about how this cold weather could potentially be hurting the wheat crop.
Yeah, that's a big debate right now in the wheat market. I don't expect the market to react really to this until we get into spring and break dormancy of the crop and get a feel for just how much damage there is. But the expectation is that there is damage there. The question is how much damage and is it significant? From an academic standpoint, we've had cold enough temperatures to do significant damage to the crop. The wheat is a funny animal, so to speak, or a funny crop, I guess I should say, in that sometimes you can have a lot more damage than what the textbook says you should based on the conditions, and sometimes you end up with a lot less damage. It's very difficult to predict, and that's why the trade's not reacting right now, and they'll hold off. But it is another one of those factors with the speculative funds holding such massive, large, short or sold positions in wheat that we'll have to watch on, because if the damage is significant at some point, we could see the funds have to get out of those short positions, and that could give us a nice rally to sell. In the meantime, their funds are trying to defend those positions. Wheat is very well priced on the global market, as is corn, and we haven't sold as much as what we would have because all of our export slots have been pretty much dedicated to shipping soybeans and to some extent corn out. Now, as we start to see export business shift to south of the equator for soybeans, I think we'll see a pickup in wheat shipments as well as corn. And I think that, too, will help us carve out a bottom. Is this the bottom? Have we put a bottom in the market? Anyone who's tried to guess that in the past has been burned. My gut says that we're certainly awfully close and that we probably have, but there is a risk with the funds continuing to try to press things. But the wheat market overall is fundamentally sound at these price levels, and I think with the amount of short positions we have, it could be justified that we could see a 40 to 50 cent rally in this market if we would simply get some type of news to scare them out of the positions. But those are hard to come about this time of year. It'd be much easier as we get closer to spring and the Northern Hemisphere crop breaks dormancy.
Again, that was Arlen Suderman of Water Street Solutions. That's all for part one of this afternoon's Farm Show. Stay tuned for part two, coming up after this.
This is Wayne Schaefer, your country financial agent in Jerseyville. Farming is more than an occupation. It's a way of life. So when you want to protect your farm, it goes a lot deeper than protecting your crops, buildings, and machinery. You can't trust your farm protection to just anyone. You want an insurance company with decades of farm experience, like Country Financial. We have insured your parents' farm, even your grandparents' farm. So let us put 80 years of experience to work for you. Find out more about farm insurance from me, your country agent in Jerseyville. Give us a call at 498-5800.
At Carlinville Truck Equipment, they think being considerate and courteous comes with the territory. Courtesy isn't merely being polite. It means honest friendship, honest prices, and honest dealing. When they put their name behind the product or service they provide for you, they do it with pride, not just in the product or service, but in having you as a customer. For your truck or trailer repair needs, call today at 217-854-6706 or visit them online at ctemi.com. Carlinville Truck Equipment, they deliver what others promise.
Haul to Jersey County Grain's Hardin River Terminal and you'll save fuel, time, and headache. You won't have to fight traffic or wait in line forever either. Barge shipping rates are low and their prices usually beat the competition. Call Jersey County Grain in Jerseyville or Hardin, or check their website for quotes at jerseycountygrain.com. You can also get daily grain bids by email or text message. See Jersey County Grain for details.
Macoupin County Farm Bureau is about more than farming. When you join Macoupin County Farm Bureau, you help fight for quality education. Macoupin County Farm Bureau believes children with a good education are the key to our state's economic success. We work with state government, teachers, and parents to find newer and better ways to finance education, ensuring quality education for all. For more details, call the Macoupin County Farm Bureau. Farm Bureau, where membership promotes quality education for our children.
Genetically modified organisms have been a bit of a hot topic lately, but mostly related to row crops, not really touching produce. Yet. Although GM technology will certainly play some role in the future of produce, there are some who do not think it will be a large role. Monsanto is developing new strains of produce that they are hoping will taste better and yield well, but they're doing it without GM technology. I spoke with David Stark, Vice President, Global Trades Partnerships, with Monsanto for more.
Well, first, traditional breeding is the backbone of every seed we sell. It always has been, and I suspect it always will be. And in the produce area, we are focused on using all of our breeding tools to help the farmer with productivity and also the consumer with having products that they just enjoy eating more.
Well, everybody loves products that they enjoy eating. Can you go ahead and tell me a bit about these different produce varieties?
Sure. So, again, we're not compromising performance on the farm. So I want to make that really clear to people that yield and disease tolerance and all the aspects that the grower needs to produce a profitable crop have to be in the seed. So this is not a trade-off. But when it comes to flavor, we've hired sensory scientists. We have sensory labs, and we're digging into what is the molecular level of what people like and they don't like. I can give you some examples of products. So melons. So here in the Midwest, I am perpetually disappointed, it seems, with the lack of flavor in our melons, especially this time of the year. And there's really no reason for it. We have looked into our global melon portfolio, and we have a whole host of flavors and aromas that we sell in different parts of the world, but we don't make available here. Well, that's changing. So, for example, at a number of retailers, including Sam's Club, we have a melon that is available in the winter. It's called Melorange. And it's unique in that it can be grown in Central America and shipped and have the shelf life that we need to get it here, but it still develops great flavor and aroma. It is actually a delicious melon.
I know exactly what you mean by being a bit disappointed in the melons this time of year. I know I just kind of stop buying until summer again.
Yes, and if we look at melon consumption, you and I are like an awful lot of people out there because melon consumption drops like a rock when the flavor resembles a rock. So, and there's really, again, there's no reason for it. So our scientists have discovered what it is about the melon that gives good flavor and aroma, and how to breed that into melons that can be available year-round. So I'm really excited about the number of new melon types that people can enjoy, not just in the summer.
It definitely sounds interesting, and it may be if these different types of produce that taste better and are and these tastier fruits are available all year round, people will eat more fruit and eat healthier foods.
Well, that's really the objective, and we do want people to eat more fruits and vegetables, but we look at all of the programs that have been out there for years and the money spent to tell people eat more fruits and vegetables, and we see that per person fruit and vegetable consumption generally has declined over the last 10 years. So I think it's the product, and it's the convenience and the taste. It's not the understanding that I need to eat more. It's, gee, make it fun to eat.
So these different types of produce are going to be tastier, but without sacrificing anything for the farmer that's going to be growing them?
Yes, and that's really important because we have, and the whole industry has things that they've offered for years that taste good, but if they don't yield well, they become really high-priced, specialty niche products that most people aren't going to see or want to purchase. So we have to make the flavor and the productivity so that the produce is widely available and affordable, part of the whole package, and that's really important to us.
And why have you decided to use crossbreeding and go along more those traditional breeding strains? I know you said that's always the foundation of everything you do, which makes sense, but it sounds like creating GMO crops, it makes things easier. So why have you decided to kind of just go along with more the traditional breeding of plants instead of inserting traits that could make these plants more efficient or more resistant to different things?
It's what most people won't see is that back in the 1990s, when we were rapidly investing in the biotechnology or GMO techniques, we were also investing in techniques that helped us breed smarter and faster. And when we entered the vegetable seed business around 2005, we saw a great opportunity to apply these tools to produce crops where we could make a lot of gains faster and, frankly, a lot less expensive. GMO technology is something that, you know, we say it's about $100 million 10-year-plus bet. And so that means that it needs to be a big problem on a crop that's grown on a lot of acres, and it can't be solved any other way. And there are not many produce crops that are big enough where we could really justify that kind of investment.
So it's much more cost-effective.
It is much more cost-effective. And again, because produce generally had not had the benefit of the better breeding techniques with the different molecular markers and genomics and such that helps us cut time out of the process, we see we can make a lot of gains just doing the breeding. There are a lot of things we'd love to do with GM and produce, and there are things that I think growers would really like. For example, in tomatoes, viruses are a problem. We could engineer immunity to a whole host of viruses. Fungal diseases are a problem, bacterial diseases, but the cost is high. It's controversial, and from a business sense, we just don't see the return yet. But that doesn't mean that it will never happen, because there are examples of people working on GM produce.
One example of a produce area looking hard into GMO technology is a new potato from Simplot called Innate. Greg Martin reports on this GMO produce.
Snake River Sugar Company's Dwayne Grant says that GMO products are making a big impact on the food industry.
I've been involved in the biotech evolution for about the last 15 years. We have successfully transitioned to Roundup Ready sugar beets starting in 2006, and that's kind of what I'm here, I think, to tell the story about, is what happened in our industry, how did the marketplace respond as we transitioned from conventional beets, was there pushback, how did our producers respond?
He says that the transition to biotechnology has been taking place since 1997.
And it has been a steady, steady growth globally in the adoption by farmers of biotechnology. Just a little under 500 million acres annually planted biotech crops. They're dominated by corn, soybeans, and cotton. You put sugar beets together with sunflower, alfalfa, rice. You could also add into there papaya. GM papaya dominate the Hawaiian papaya industry. The Hawaiian papaya industry would not exist.
And Grant says there are a lot of fruits and vegetables in the marketplace that depend on GM technology.
So the message here is, hey, potatoes aren't first. This is a very successful technology. It's moving forward. So, you know, that's the message. It's not just a Monsanto technology. It's not just a technology for high capital, very intensive ag for the Western world. This is a global technology. It's being adopted globally.
I'm Greg Martin.
So overall, a lot happening in the produce industry on both sides of the GMO debate. That's all for this afternoon's Farm Show. For WSMI, I'm Angela Besh. Thanks for tuning in.